Hello out there in internet land, and welcome once again to the D&D podcast. I'm your host, Mike Merles, and with me as usual is Jeremy Crawford.
Hello, everyone.
This week, we're going to tackle two big subjects, the D&D Essentials, the upcoming line. We're going to go into a little more detail on some of the products there. We're also going to talk about the upcoming Castle Ravenloft board game, which is due to release on August 31st. And we also have an interview with Rodney Thompson, conducted by our own Shelley Mazenoble, player-in-chief. And so sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. So as we're recording this, it's August 27th, and the D&D, the new starter set, the red box, as we call it, because the box it comes in is red, and it hails back to the classic red box from 83, and the Elmore one, the Elmore one was 83, and then the El Otis one was from 81. So that's the new starter set. It's coming out September 7th. There's a game day September 11th, and we're pretty excited about it.
There are some questions out there about what's in the starter set. What is its relationship to the rest of the Essentials line and to Dungeons & Dragons itself? This even came up in a recent Penny Arcade comic about in the comic it shows, I don't remember if it's Tycho or Gabe, holding on to the red box and sort of resenting it that it's changed his beloved fourth edition. The thing to be clear about the red box is that it is the starter set in the Essentials line. It is the set that we have designed specifically for people who have never played Dungeons & Dragons before. It walks you through a solo adventure, creating your character. It helps the DM run his or her first adventures. You know, it has a battle mat, it has tokens, it has the dice you need. It is truly Dungeons & Dragons in a box. You know, you get that and you have a few levels of play. For our experienced players, this box definitely does not have all the options that we all expect of Dungeons & Dragons. It does not go up through all of the levels, doesn't have adventure design tools for the dungeon master.
So you can make, the DM does have enough tools to make up an adventure.
Sure.
And you could potentially make up a couple of them.
Right.
But it kind of tells you, okay, use the included map and here are some tokens of the monsters and stuff.
Right. Yeah, there definitely are some knobs to turn for the DM, some things to customize. The classes that we provide are the four iconic D&D classes. We've got the fighter, we have the wizard, we have the cleric, and we have the rogue. And not only are there just those four iconics, but there are specific versions of them. We have the slayer fighter, we have the war priest cleric, we have the thief rogue, and we have the mage wizard. And to make sure it's clear to everybody, even though in that starter set we have the slayer fighter, who's a striker rather than a defender, the defender fighter isn't going anywhere. He's still a stable part of 4th edition Dungeons & Dragons, both in his player's handbook form, but also in his knight form, because in Heroes of the Fallen Lands, one of the other Essentials products, which comes out on September 21st, we introduce both the slayer and the knight. And the knight is another option for people who want to play a defender fighter. Anything else, Mike, about the red box?
Yeah, the really important thing to keep in mind about it is, and this ties into the Essentials line as a whole, is the red box seeks to deliver a complete experience. It's everything you'd need in one box. It has maps for the encounters and the included adventure. For the DM, for the part of the DM creating his own adventure, it shows you how to use that, how to modify that map to create new encounter areas, new dungeon areas to explore. Comes with tokens for the monsters, for the characters, comes with dice. It's really all about giving you a product where if someone, hey, I want to learn how to play D&D, here's everything you need in one box, just buy this one thing, start playing it, and you're good to go. You know, it's getting away from the idea of having to buy, like you're not really sure maybe what a new player has to buy, that's not really clear, you know. And that really ties into the Essentials line as a whole. It kind of segues into to the next topic. When we talk about Essentials, there's a lot of confusion. I know some of you, this is kind of a joke of like, how many times, are we going to bring this up? But as long as we still see people out there with some confusion and trying to figure it out, we're going to keep talking about it and trying to make it
right,
clear.
Right.
And it comes down to the idea of, hey, is Essentials, is that D&D 4.5? And it is not. The way I like to think of it, and I'm going to use an MMO analogy, so I hope people don't get, and it does not mean the D&D is turning into MMO or anything like that, but it's almost like, imagine if
we're playing with spectral computers somehow.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you could imagine a game like World of Warcraft, where there are established character classes and options, like, you know, there's the warrior, there's the mage, you can play a troll, you can play a dwarf. Essentials is kind of like saying, okay, all that stuff's still in the game.
I'm amazed you got those things right.
Since
you don't play World of Warcraft.
I played the game for a month. I gave it a try. I did give it a try. I am a first-person shooter player. I like Halo. That's my game. But you can imagine that if they were in our position, where we look at our game and go, hey, we think our game's great, but we want to make it easier for new players to get into it. You can imagine an MMO like World of Warcraft just saying, hey, if you're playing a warrior, well, here are a couple new options you can choose. You're still playing a warrior. You could still play the old warrior, but we're going to make an on-ramp for people to make it easier to just get into the game.
Which is, in fact, what Blizzard is essentially doing with their upcoming Cataclysm expansion. They're creating a new starter experience for their players.
And that's really all it is. It doesn't change anything you're currently playing. It's the same rule set. It's the same game you've been playing before. We're just adding more options to it. And there's a kind of a twist to it in the sense, okay, we made these new options. And I think some people look at it. I saw this comment on one of the forums that Essentials feels kind of like it's almost D&D 3.9. You know, in a way, I think it's just the way we approach the design. It is something where it gets, for some of the classes, like the fighter, the slayer, and the knight, it gets a little bit away from powers to simplify things. But I also think just naturally in the way that's designed, it's going to appeal to people who maybe just didn't like having powers with their fighter. You know, there are no daily powers, for instance, in the slayer. You instead have stances. You still have utilities, but it's really focusing on your stances. And there's a mechanic called Power Strike, which is similar to an encounter power. Essentially, it's a boost. If you hit someone, you can use your Power Strike to do more damage to them on top of that hit.
Right. And really, the point is, particularly for our experienced 4th edition player, we are aiming to provide a broader array of play options.
Yeah, exactly.
So that it's not a sort of one-size-fits-all approach to class design.
Exactly.
So if someone comes to Heroes of the Fallen Lands and then Heroes of the Forgotten Kingdoms, which is the second Essentials player book that will be coming out later this year, and they want to play the class that has a bunch of powers and a bunch of tactical options, we have those classes. We have the wizard, the cleric, even to a certain extent, is built that way. But the person who wants the straightforward class, who is just going to wade into battle and hew off heads, we have the slayer for that player.
And even if that player wants to play something a little more complicated, the original fighter is still in there.
Yeah.
It's still in the character builder. Mm-hmm. It's not going away.
Yeah.
And
then we provide the knight, which in a way is sort of a midpoint, I think, between the player's handbook fighter and the slayer.
Yeah, he's a defender, so he's going to be a little more complicated to learn how to play, mm-hmm. but that's just a natural part of it. But yeah, like you said, it's about reestablishing a range of complexity that players can opt into.
Yeah.
You know, and when I think of things like this, it really ties into the idea of the culture of D&D. You know, I think it's, if you look back at D&D's history, people are used to being able to say, this is the fighter, and that's the canonical expression of the fighter. If you change this, you're changing the game in some fundamental way. And what we're doing here is saying there are several fighters. You know, the fighter as a concept means something. It's a guy who's very good with weapons. He doesn't use magic. He's tough, he's tough in a fight. But there's a couple of different expressions we can use because we know D&D is a game that appeals to a very broad variety of interests. Some people play D&D because they want a power game. You want to make the most powerful character you can possibly make and destroy monsters as quickly as possible. Some people play D&D purely for the story. They can't even remember their character's stats or what spells do. They're just there for the world and the story and the action, the stuff. You know, those people that you meet when they say, we played D&D for 8 hours and didn't roll a single die and it was awesome. You know, you could, D&D of all the games out there is so flexible and is so variable in how people use it. And that's its strength. But it's something that we, when we look at the game from the big picture, we're trying to acknowledge, you know, that there is no one right way to play D&D. R&D isn't interested in saying, this is how you must play D&D. We want to give you guys the tools, the options to play D&D the way you want to play D&D. And I think this is kind of the first time mechanically we're in some ways acknowledging that. You know, that the game isn't a one-size-fits-all solution. There's a lot of different ways you can play D&D.
I mean, in some ways, and this is only, I think, a somewhat helpful analogy, is in some ways, I feel like we are hearkening back to the days when there was basic D&D and there was advanced D&D. Now, the reason why I prefaced what I'm about to say by saying it's not a totally accurate analogy, because back in the day, those were essentially two different games.
Yes.
But what we are hearkening back to is in the first edition days, especially when you had Advanced Dungeons and Dragons in the hardbound books, and then the Larry Elmore Red Box by Frank Mentzer, those were two different modes of Dungeons and Dragons. Yet, at the end of the day, everyone could still recognize that they were both D&D, even though the rules were often different, the classes were different. I mean, heck, in one, elf was a race, and the other, elf was a class.
Yeah.
But you still knew the essence of D&D is in both of these games. Now, with Essentials and the rest of 4th edition, the divide is not that strong.
Yeah, there is no divide.
There is no divide.
Yeah, it is the same game.
But, again, what we're trying to get at and what they had back then was this give different ways of playing D&D.
Exactly. Now, the difference is, you can imagine back then, if you're one of the veteran players like myself who played back then, you could just imagine a red box that was released with the rules were the same. And you can imagine the classes being a little bit different, so here's a simpler version of it. Here's a cleric that doesn't get spells at first level.
Right.
He has no first level spells, because so if you're first level playing a cleric, you're just going to bash monsters with your mace, then you'll gain a spell. And you can imagine, to further this analogy, in AD&D there are like subclasses. You know, the cleric was a class, and then druid was a subclass of cleric. You can imagine someone just calling, say, the basic D&D, the red box D&D cleric, an acolyte.
Right.
And just saying, look, the acolyte is a subclass of cleric. So in this red box, you're getting the acolyte, but in AD&D, in D&D as a whole, there's still a cleric, there's still a druid. Those guys interact with each other. And I think one of the strengths of 4th edition is that the core rules are fairly simple. You know, the combat chapter is fairly streamlined. It's all very modular. So we're able to do this in the red box. You know, one of the exciting things to me about the red box, about the starter set, is it's the first time in a long while we've been able to put rules for character creation in there. Because in the past, If the rules for creating a character were a little more involved, and you had to understand a lot more about the core rules, the basic physics of the game, before you can make informed choices about your character. And now, with a more exceptions-based approach, we can more easily partition out those pieces. You know, we can tell you, hey, if for example you're gonna pick a skill, you can choose between, say, stealth and thievery, and it's just that choice. It's not, well, you have skill ranks to pick, or, well, it depends on what your intelligence is and what your class is, you know, and for non-weapon proficiencies. You know, it's a little bit of it's a more modular system. It's easier for us to hash it out, to let you make a character with this kind of experience, and not at the end have you thinking, okay, I learned to make a character, but the core rules I just learned, they're actually not the real rules. I need to relearn the game.
Granted, the character creation is also easier to present now because James Wyatt did such a great job of creating that solo adventure which guides you through that process.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we're pretty excited about it. And just a quick recap, it releases September 7th. There's a game day September 11th, so head down to your local game store and get in on a Redbox game and experience D&D for the first time again.
So before we go on to another topic, I have sort of a D&D nostalgia question for
okay.
you, Mike.
Oh, fire.
Did you learn D&D originally back in the 80s or late 70s with a red box, whether it was the Larry Elmore
nope.
one or the Errol Otis?
No, I did not. I learned from the J. Eric Holmes 1978 basic set. Mr. Holmes, Dr. Holmes, I should say. Sadly, he passed away this year. I inherited that set when my brother and his friends got the red box and decided they didn't need that old set anymore. So it ended up falling into my hands. And that's where I learned how to play. I learned to play D&D from that set. And I ended up buying a red box. I never actually bought the Errol Otis cover one. I ended up buying the Larry Elmore cover one because I needed the dice. And I bought my D&D supplies from a bookstore that didn't sell dice. So I was like, well, I need some new dice. I'll just buy this red box and it has a set of dice.
And you got some books in the bargain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I learned D&D from the AD&D Player's Handbook, the first edition one. And I think I learned at first from a friend's copy that had the original painting on the cover with the idol and, you know, them prying out the gem. But the first copy I owned myself was the one with the second cover.
Oh yeah,
with,
wizard
with the wizard.
And the gargoyles.
Yeah, the gargoyles, and it sort of had the blue background. Yeah. So I still have very fond memories of that because for me that was my first player's handbook.
Yeah, I still that's the first player's handbook I own too. I still have my copy signed by Gary Gygax. It is at my house right now in my office.
But even though I learned from that, I think on, it was either a Christmas or a birthday. Someone in my family got me the Larry Elmore Red Box. And even though I already had the Player's Handbook, I was delighted to get it. I think also because of the dice.
Yeah. Dice were hard to find back then.
And it's funny, even as a kid, I was able to tell right away that these were sort of two different expressions of D&D. And my friends and I normally played AD&D, but we did actually run a few Redbox adventures because we thought it was fun to do kind of a stripped down version of the game.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you were playing an elf and someone would say, well, what's your class? Elf.
Yeah. I advance as both a fighter and a magic user.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of old school stuff, old school D&D stuff, mm-hmm. that I won't speak for you, I'll just speak for myself, that I also love. Let's talk about Ravenloft.
Yeah, I never actually played through Ravenloft.
Have you never played through I-6? I've
never played it. And the first time I read it was I read it for a project I worked on last year that just is coming out on August 31st.
Outrageous, Mike Merles.
Isn't it crazy?
I've never played through I-6, but I think I have DM'd the original adventure 4 or 5 times.
The one time we came close to playing it, we had second-level characters, and the DM was like, I'm going to run you through this awesome adventure.
And you were probably just wasted.
Yeah, no, and what I said, and he put the module down, the cover, like they used to do back in the day, he put the cover down and uses a DM screen, and we're all looking at it going, this is for like 6th-level characters, you know that, right? And he was like, well, then the road doesn't lead into this, like, dark and misty thing. It's, and he starts going through his collection of adventures for what we're going to run next. So I've never actually played it. I dodged it the one time. We would have been slaughtered as second-level characters. But, yeah, so we have this board game coming out, Castle Ravenloft, the board game.
Yeah, we talked about it a bit in our Gen Con podcast. Rather than waxing nostalgic for 10 minutes about my beloved Ravenloft, how about we talk a bit about not only this board game, but just sort of board games in general?
Sure.
Because we have more board games following in line after yep. Castle Ravenloft.
We've got Castle Ravenloft on August 31st. And then in November, we have Wrath of Ashardalon. That uses the same basic system, same format, and is compatible with Ravenloft.
And so does that mean that we will be providing guidelines for how the two board games can interact in some way?
Well, I want to start publishing scenarios on the website. And one of the nice things is with the way the game is set up, with the decks of cards and the treasure and everything, we can essentially give you guidelines in a scenario and say, okay, combine these monsters from this game, these monsters from this other game, and then this set of cards with this set of cards, and now you have a unique set to play through this adventure with. So it's pretty exciting because we're using the same basic system. Like once you've learned how to play Castle Ravenloft, the only thing if you bought Wrath of Ashardalon, you just have to learn, you just look at the new scenarios and start using those.
So with these two games, both of which are cooperative, were there particular game mechanic goals that you had for them, Mike?
Yeah, the really big thing, the key thing was getting across the feeling of playing D&D. And one of the really important parts of that, I think, is the sense of exploration. I remember back when TSR published a game called Dragon Strike, and they also had a board game called Dungeon.
Was Dragon Strike the one with the videotape?
Yes, with the hyper-reality videotapes.
Yes.
Which are really interesting.
I think the first time I saw it was years ago at Comic-Con, actually, in San Diego. Yeah,
oh, wow.
And there was a booth, and I remember seeing the video there.
So the thing that was disappointing me about those games was the board had the dungeon on it, and you could see the entire dungeon. And that to me was lame. That's not D&D. Like, what kind of DM would just, here's the map of the entire dungeon, now go explore it? Well, we don't need to explore it. We have this entire map of it. Who cares, right? So that was something very important, was this idea of tile laying. And the game being fairly random in the sense of the events being different, like the encounter cards, the monster card draws, just the draws of the tiles. I, for fun, because I'm maybe testing out a new character class I'm designing for the game, maybe I'm doing that. I've been playing the solo version a lot, and it's funny how this narrative appears. Like, I kind of have this theory of board game design, of game design in general. If you have enough random elements, if those random elements are interesting on their own, they're even more interesting when they randomly become chained together in events. So I have the one game where I'm playing the wizard and I don't draw, like, Through mechanics of the game, I ended up drawing very few encounter cards because it was just very lucky draws, and I escape because of that. Or the game where I'm playing the fighter and I have this one, if I make this attack, I'm going to win, and I roll, you know, two, like, 19s in a row and kill two monsters back-to-back, and I'm able to escape, you know. And or I was playing the ranger and just got overwhelmed, the you know, things like that, where this narrative emerges because of these events. And I think just as the human brain has this tendency to just sort of try to make sense of these events, and if you put good events in the game that feel like they would go together, it's very easy to put those together and understand, oh, here's the narrative of the game, here's the experience of it, here's the story of the game. And not a story in the sense of you're playing the game and going, oh, what would be a really good denouement to this scene or whatever. It's just more, it's like a sport, you know, like where if you play, say, a soccer match or watch a baseball game, you can think, oh, like after you watch it, you can think back and go, well, there's the dramatic moment when, you know, there's this really critical play just as time was expiring or at the end of the game. And that just makes a good story, you know. And I think that's in board game design, that's something I try to seek, is to create these things where when the game is over and you look back, you think to yourself, well, here's what was really interesting about that. Like, you kind of have this urge. It's almost like the let me tell you about my character thing in D&D,
right,
or my campaign, where you kind of want to tell someone, hey, here's what happened. And that was interesting. It wasn't just a bunch of random events. It wasn't a boring progression of, you know, expected events. It was something where, like, I didn't expect this to happen, and it all kind of made sense and fit together well and makes an interesting story.
Well, and I think you're touching on something that not only do we see in board games, but is also a part of the core D&D experience, I think. That one reason why people often want to retell what's happened to their characters or what's happened in their campaigns, if they're the DMs, is there's an excitement because there's always an element of surprise, even for the Dungeon Master.
Yes.
Because of the random element, because of the simple resolution mechanic using dice, not even the Dungeon Master always knows how a particular scenario is going to play out. And so that creates this sense of discovery. Like, wow, I had no idea they were going to get destroyed by the Dracolich.
Yeah.
Or I had no idea they were going to win.
Yep.
Or that they were going to win in that particular way.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the most enjoyable things about games for me, is that experience of looking back and going, the game makes sense as a narrative. You know, again, it's not about designing a game that specifically produces narratives, but it's just a game that lends itself to that experience where you're really absorbed by it and you feel like you're living through this really interesting series of events. It's why, I mean, frankly, my attitude toward board games is, I may have mentioned this on the podcast before, but a board game where the theme casts me as something I could do in real life, like become a farmer, is nowhere near as interesting to me as, like, becoming a dragon rider or becoming a powerful wizard or leading an army of space marines or, you know, things like that.
Right.
Or even just like being a race car driver. I couldn't physically do that. But, you know, if it's just like, you know, running a dollar store or farming some land, like I could do that in theory in my life right now. And I choose not to.
Yes.
Yeah. So those kind of games, that theme, just theme is really important to me in a game.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm expecting to play Castle Ravenloft this weekend. And I'm hoping we will finally draw the scenario that has Strahd in it.
Yeah.
I still haven't fought Strahd.
If you have a copy of the game, the solo adventure does involve, if you have the right sequence of draws, Strahd does make an appearance. And I have been chased out of the crypts twice by Strahd. So, and you can't beat him on your own. You just have to run.
Yeah.
So that's the warning. If you play the solo scenario, don't try to stand and fight him if he starts chasing you. Just get the heck out of Dodge.
Which is also true, and not only in I6, but also in the third edition expedition to Castle Ravenloft. Yeah. If you are in a small group, run if Strahd shows up.
Exact. Good advice.
Yes. Run for your life.
Hi everyone, this is Shelley Mazenoble, Player-in-Chief, and I'm here with a very special guest, Rodney Thompson.
Hello.
Hi, Rodney.
Hi.
Thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
My pleasure.
You're much nicer than your other cohorts over there.
Really?
Yeah, like, they just won't talk to me at all. But I wanted to talk to you today because you played a very important role in a very important product that is getting a lot of buzz out right now, Dark Sun.
Yes.
Your role on that was lead
developer.
Developer.
Yes.
Okay. And I pause there because I'm assuming other people,
yes,
sometimes get a little bit confused between the difference between developer and designer.
Right.
So what is the difference?
So a designer actually starts the process. The designer is the one responsible for coming up with all the initial ideas for a product or a mechanic or a story element. And then the developers take those ideas that have gotten the initial design, and we would take that apart and analyze it and playtest it and apply our general knowledge about how the game has developed over the last X number of years, and then make sure that those mechanics that we've created are up to snuff and basically are doing what we want them to do, not causing any problems. It's a lot of it is sort of like mechanical editing, making sure that everything is clear and concise and also plays well at the table. So my responsibility on Dark Sun was to take the initial design done by Rich Baker, Rob Schwab, Chris Sims, Bruce Cordell, Logan Bonner, Ari Marmel, Travis Stout, take all of that design that they had done, and then me and my team, we broke it down into its parts and analyzed them and made sure that everything was doing what we wanted it to do to produce a better game experience.
Wow. No pressure or anything.
No. It's very exciting because you get to work in a team a lot, which yeah. Oftentimes design is, okay, I'm going to work in a team to concept it, but then we go off into our own separate parts to do the actual design work. But as a developer, you spend a lot of time sitting around with your other developers, talking about the merits and flaws of certain mechanics, asking questions of each other and saying, you know, does this really do what we want it to do, etc. So there's a lot more interaction in a development environment than there is in design necessarily. Now, all that having been said,
yes.
Now, even though I was lead developer on Dark Sun, I am now a designer. And so I spend a lot of time doing design work. And what I've tried to do is bring a little bit of that development philosophy, that sort of teamwork, coordination, collaboration philosophy from development into design as well. So I've spent a lot of time harassing my fellow designers now
and
making them look at my ideas and see if they like what I'm doing. So it's... development has been traditionally very teamwork based, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, it seems like having having done both, it probably helps you in I would imagine in both roles.
I was officially a developer for almost 2 years before making the transition to design recently, and that experience was absolutely invaluable. I feel like having done the development work, I now am a much better designer. So.
Yeah.
It also helps you cultivate skills like teamwork and things like that I think they're very important in an environment like ours.
Yeah, definitely. And you guys do seem like you're a good team.
Right, despite the fact that no one wants to hang out with you, apparently.
Yeah,
according
whatever.
To you.
Yeah. I don't know about that part of the team. Just curious about your background. Mm-hmm. And you did play D&D before you came to work here.
Yes, I started playing D&D around 1992. I heard of D&D for the first time when I was much younger, but I didn't actually start playing until about 1992, well into second edition, and my very first D&D campaign was actually in the Al-Qadim setting, which was our sort of Arabian Nights setting that TSR published. I guess that would have been closer to like 1993 was when we started our campaign, but I really started playing when I was about 12 years old.
Oh.
Yeah.
So who told you about D&D before?
When I was like 8 or 9 years old, there was a kid that lived 2 doors down from me. And he went to his cousin's house one day and he said, you know, he comes back and tells me the story. He's like, you know, I played this game with my cousins and I was a halfling and I had this sling and I put like oil on my sling bullet and set it on fire and shot flaming bullets at people. And I was like, what kind of game are you talking about? I want to go to there, right? I mean, it was just one of those things that I had never had any concept of that because all I had played was like Nintendo games,
right?
Like I had a NES at the time, I guess is what it would have been. I had no concept of a game that was that creative. So I'm 8 years old hearing about all this crazy stuff that you can do, and it's not, you know, for another 4 years before I actually get to play D&D for the first time and see, okay, this is what that guy was talking about.
Yeah, it wasn't him that you played with?
No. He actually moved away when I was like 10 years old, so just a couple of years later he moved away, and none of my friends that I knew at the time knew anything about D&D, and so it wasn't until I got to... I guess you would call it junior high, before I met a guy that was like, hey, I run D&D, do you want to join my game? And I was like, yeah, I think I want to play this game that I heard so much about 4 years ago.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So certainly back when you were, you know, 12, 13, whatever, playing D&D, and when you were playing Dark Sun in second edition, it wasn't like you were playing it and thinking, God, I could make this so much better. Or if I were designing this, I would change this. But then years later, you got a chance to, you know, to work on Dark Sun again.
Right.
So.
It's funny. I kind of give Rich Baker a hard time sometimes because Dark Sun came out. It started coming out in, I think, 93 or 92, 93, and then was produced until 1996, sort of in the prime of my learning about D&D years. And so when Rich and I started working on the project, he was obviously the lead designer, and I was like, Rich, this is really exciting for me because I'm going to get to finally help work on a product that you worked on like 15 years ago.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he was not as happy about that. But it was actually really great for me because, like I say, at the time that he was producing this material, like Valley of Dust and Fire was one of the supplements he worked on back in second edition, I was buying those, and these were really formative to my
gaming
experience. Yeah, but you know, it seems like a long time ago, but in the grand scheme of things, it's all just D&D, so it's not like that a whole lot has changed. I mean, some has changed, but it's still all sort of the same D&D, so the same Dark Sun. So it was really, really a big deal for me getting to work on Dark Sun.
Dark Sun was very different for me when I played it. It's a much different D&D than I'm used to. I'm playing in the Encounters season and just getting my butt kicked and left.
It's interesting. Sort of my formative experiences with D&D were Al-Qadim and Dark Sun, the Arabian Nights setting and the sort of sword and sandal, harsh desert environment setting of Dark Sun. So I had a very different introduction, and it wasn't until like 97, 98, that I played in a traditional Forgotten Realms campaign that was a little more high fantasy and everything. So I had some weird formative experiences as far as D&D goes. Yeah.
Yeah, we kept, as soon as our first session with Encounters, we were like, but what's our goal? What are we looking for?
Survive.
Who are we trying to find? Yeah, and that's what our DMs just kept saying, like, you need to survive.
Right.
And usually, admittedly, we're a little bit lax about making sure that we actually have the proper supplies to survive anywhere.
Right.
And the emphasis, he kept saying, like, you really need to get food. You really need to stock up on water. We're like, whatever. Yeah, now I get it. But.
Right. I was actually really lucky that my DM in high school was very story focused. Mm-hmm. So we didn't often get bogged down in the minutiae of tracking because, honestly, I think he knew that our attention spans weren't going to handle that.
Yeah.
So we were able to have some really good experiences without necessarily having to do a whole lot of tracking of, like, okay, how much water do you have? How much food do you have? And yet at the same time, he also did a good job of impressing me with that, okay, survival is a really important aspect. So I was really fortunate that I kind of got the best of both worlds.
It does change how you play. Like just with that underlying sense of, this is all about surviving.
Right.
Like, I feel like my character is maybe a little more of a risk taker. Maybe just making more rash, impetuous decisions than, say, like Tabitha, who can just kind of chill out in the background.
Desperation makes you take risks, right? And Dark Sun is definitely a desperation building setting.
Yes.
Right? So
absolutely.
Yeah. It creates different kinds of stories that I think is really cool. I mean, normally I might gloss over overland travel, for example, in a D&D game. My players just recently traveled from Icewind Dale down to Baldur's Gate in the Forgotten Realms campaign, and that was basically 10 minutes of me describing the journey, right? If I was to do that in Dark Sun, say having them travel between Tyr and Uruk, the other city states, that would be a whole adventure in and of itself. And it's interesting because it makes you tell different kinds of stories.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
So how did you end up here at Wizards?
I started freelancing for Wizards in, I want to say, 2001 on the Star Wars role-playing game. And I actually just got really lucky. I had a fan website that was all about the Star Wars role-playing game, both the old West End Games version and then the Wizards of the Coast version that had just come out. Oh. And Chris Perkins found my website, and he and J.D. Weicker basically looked at my stuff and said, hey, we think this guy's stuff would be, you know, useful in a book. And so they had me do a freelance project that was the Heroes Guide for Star Wars Revised Edition. And that set me on the path to freelancing. Then in 2007, I got the job running the Star Wars role-playing game here at Wizards. And about a year and a half after that, I transitioned over to Dungeons & Dragons. Still had my Star Wars responsibilities, but also doing Dungeons & Dragons. And so now here I am as a designer 8-9 years later.
Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, it was a heck of a journey. Yeah. It helped me get through college, right, freelancing. I worked for a lot of different companies, made a lot of really good friends with other freelancers and other publishers.
Yeah.
So I don't necessarily miss the job hunting aspect of freelancing, but it was actually a really great experience for me.
Yeah, it seems like it would be.
Yeah.
And I always like to ask that question because so many people are curious how to get into the game industry, you know, and especially in R&D.
Sure.
So it's I like hearing people's entry points. And a lot of times it does start with freelancing and just making those connections. And
well, one of the things that I get asked that a lot as well is how do you become a game designer? And what I like to say is that if I can do it, anybody can do it. Because there's not really anything special about my, you know, my formative years that made me any different from any other D&D player. I just happened to... I happen to have the desire to create, and I think a lot of our DMs do as well, that plus I was an English major, like I was talking to you earlier about, so I had the advantage of learning how to write and communicate effectively, and really at that point it turned into my ability to look at games and analyze them and be critical of them while also seeing what's fun about them. Really, the best way to become a game designer is to play a lot of games. That sounds terrible, right? Yeah,
life.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, they do have game design as a major at a lot of colleges.
They
now.
Do. In fact, a good friend of mine, Stephen Rodney McFarland, teaches a game design course locally as well. It's always fun because he and I will have lunch occasionally, and he'll be telling me, yeah, my class was saying so-and-so about this thing that you designed. I was like, oh, that's great.
Oh,
that's great.
Yeah. Well, is it hard for you now to play other games as a game designer and without overanalyzing things, or can you actually still enjoy the experience?
It's not hard for me, but it might be tough on people that play the game with me. I know that my girlfriend doesn't like to play board games with me and my fellow game designers as much anymore because we do get pretty analytical. At the same time, I think that one of the most important parts of being a game designer is being able to look at a game and see what's fun about it, right? I mean, you can see its flaws, but you also need to be able to see, you know, this is what this game does really well. So I like to play a lot of different kinds of board games, card games, video games, etc., not only just for fun and recreation, but also because I feel like every time I play a new game, I'm learning something more about my own profession. But, you know, we're all sort of in this job because we loved games in the first place, so it hasn't changed that for me.
That's good. So playing games doesn't feel like homework?
No. And in fact, Tammy, my girlfriend, often asks me, she's like, how can you come home and work on your D&D campaign after working on D&D all day at work? And it's like, well, you know, if you worked on D&D all day at work, you probably wouldn't be tired of it yet either, right?
Well, your girlfriend is a pastry chef, right?
She is, so,
yeah.
You know,
she
comes...
She's why I stopped baking for you guys.
Well, yeah, she comes home at night.
I'm not competing with that.
She comes home at night and cooks dinner and cooks this wonderful meal. I'm like, well, how can you do that and not be sick of it because you did that all day at work? It's sort of the same thing for me with D&D. If you like what you do for a living, you know, you may not burn out as easily. Now, I probably wouldn't do it every single night, but I still play games, right? In fact, just the other night, I came home and we busted out Ticket to Ride, and she obliterated me at it. Terrible at it, but board games, card games, anything like that, it's close enough. I mean, it's obviously a game, right? So it's close enough to what I do for a living that I learn something from it, but far enough from sitting down and writing 5,000 words a day or whatever that I still can get enjoyment out of it.
Oh, okay. That says a lot.
Yeah.
And let's hope that you continue to get enjoyment out of that.
I hope so too. I haven't burned out yet, so.
Okay, good. So one last thing.
Sure.
This was a fun thing that you did. You and some other wizards took a train from here to Chicago,
effectively,
technically.
Yes.
And then went the rest of the way by car to Gen Con.
That's right.
The game train. How was that?
The game train was awesome. It actually started out as just an idea for a road trip that we then spun into a train trip because a train trip is kind of like a road trip where no one has to be the driver.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And I actually can't recommend it enough. Basically, we got on the train, and then for 2 days, we didn't have to worry about anything except for our own entertainment, right?
Yeah, that's easy.
They got food, everything. They had a great observation car. We could just sit and watch the American scenery roll by. We played Castle Ravenloft. We played D&D. I brought my laptop and played StarCraft, right? It was a really great experience because it was just sort of a nice, relaxing way to travel and also play a lot of games. And I designed a special Dark Sun adventure for the train that we basically played over the course of the 2 days that we were on the train. I had to buy some special components, right? A special kind of battle mat so that I could pack things light, yeah. but also get everything I needed on the train. Yep. I used tokens instead of miniatures. But in the end, it turned out to be a really great experience that I'm hoping to replicate again next year.
So you guys want to do that again?
I think so, yeah. We all agreed that we had a great time.
And, it sounded like it.
Yeah, and plus, like, we spent a day in Chicago, got to go eat nice Chicago-style pizza.
Where'd you end up going for that?
We went to Giordano's, which I've been to a couple times.
And?
I love it. I love it.
Right? I didn't have the best experience
there. Really?
Yeah.
Really?
But there was another pizza place, Lou Malnati's.
Right.
Delicious.
Okay.
That totally, because I was thinking, Chicago pizza, you're not all that, whatever. Mm-hmm. But
No, it is. It is, right.
It's really good.
Yeah, I've only been to Chicago a couple of times, but every time I've been there, I've been at Giordano's. And so this time, you know, we took the train. We had a great two-day experience. We get off the train in Chicago, spend a day in Chicago, which is a fabulous city, hop in the car, drive to Indianapolis, spend a day in Indianapolis just going around to game stores in the Indianapolis area, which was a lot of fun. And then we start the best 4 days in gaming, which is Gen Con. So I basically had a whole week that was full of gaming / tourism awesomeness.
Wow.
Yeah, I absolutely
plan to do it.
I'm definitely doing great things to be their spokesman here. But yeah, it was they really take care of you on the train, and it is so unlike the experience of flying or even driving across the country that I definitely want to do it again. And plus, there's something to be said for sort of restricting yourself by being all in one location for 2 days. It sort of forces you to play D&D, right? Like, we might say here, okay, we're gonna play a 2-day D&D marathon, and we might play one day, and then everybody would sort of drift off and be like, we'll do it some other time, right? But when you're on a train, there's nowhere to go.
Yeah.
Right? You're responsible for your own entertainment. So it really forced us to stay on track, and you know, we had enough diversions. No pun intended. Oh, terrible. Now I wish I hadn't said that.
You wish I didn't call you out.
Right, thank you.
You didn't even mean it, though.
That's cool. This is why none of my coworkers
want to know. Oh, now you found out.
No, but it was really great, and I can't recommend the experience enough. And in fact, I'm hoping that next year I can convince some of my other coworkers here to go with us, because I wouldn't recommend necessarily doing it by yourself, but having a couple other people there on the train with you, it was really great.
So maybe even you could convince other people going to Gen Con from here to there.
We'll see about that.
Maybe they could meet you at one of the stops.
Sure.
Or at least they could be there as the train rolled by, and they could wave goodbye to you.
Yeah, I think I'd have to be a little bit more famous for that to happen, right?
Oh, you're on your way, Rod.
That's what I hear. That's what
I hear. Yeah. I don't want to take up any more of your time.
No, thank you.
I know you're clearly a busy man, but I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Always my pleasure.
Good. Well, you say that now. Thank you again.
Sure.
This is Shelley Mazenoble, your player in chief. Until next time.
All right, we're going to close the podcast, as we have started to do, with a couple of mailbag questions. These are questions either about the rules, or about running the game, or about the right snacks. No, I'm kidding. We haven't done any snacks questions
yet.
We should, though.
Yeah,
people need to send in their snacks questions.
You don't want too many carbs, you get sleepy.
That's right.
You want protein. It's true. It's scientifically accurate.
All right, Mike, so why don't you ask me the first question?
Right, this first question comes from James, and his question is, hey guys, please shed some light on this for our group. Can you climb as part of a charge? Now, normally that is the question. You'd stop there, but there's also a very important piece of evidence to come next. Ragnar Thunderwhacker, who is a dwarf if there ever was one, would like to think
Watch out, Thunder, because he's going to whack you.
Yeah, no, it's... yes, would like to think that he can rush up the side of a building to charge his foe. Is it possible? Now, I'm going to weigh in before you.
Ooh, you're going to answer the question DM, yourself.
Ragnar Thunderwhacker, he wants to rush up the side of a building... Oh, hell yeah, I'd let you do that. I don't care what the rule book says. I'm the DM. You got an awesome character name, and you're doing something awesome. Dude, +4 to your attack roll.
Well, luckily, Mike, your hell yeah response is supported by the rules.
Nice! Yes, way to go, Dungeons & Dragons. Gold star.
Because the charge rules are, you know, when you charge, you can move up to your speed.
Which could be a climb.
Exactly. Because climbing... climbing can be done as a part of your movement, no matter what that movement is.
It is good to know that Ragnar Thunderwhacker, Mr. Thunderwhacker, who, if he isn't a dwarf, is a dwarf in spirit and therefore respected by me, a noted player of dwarves. I love playing dwarves.
It's true. I think every time I've played with you, you've played a dwarf.
I like playing dwarves. I like playing the surly, kind of clueless, low charisma dwarf. It's fun.
Yeah.
First character I made up for D&D using a 1978 J.R.R. Holmes edited set was a dwarf.
Awesome.
So, Mr. Thunderwhacker, charge on, my friend.
And Mr. Thunderwhacker, not only can you climb as a part of a charge, you could jump, you could swim. Basically, if it's a mode of movement, you can try it during a charge.
So if you want to get fancy, you could jump, climb, and swim just for the hell of it.
You could.
And just make your attack.
Of course, the risk is you might fail, say, the jump check, and you fall flat on your face.
I wouldn't.
You would not.
I would not. My character would.
And I
would.
And I doubt Mr. Thunderwhacker would fail.
With the name like Thunderwhacker, he will not.
Yes.
All right, so that question's solved.
All right, and our second and last question for today. This is coming from an anonymous querier. He or she says, I'm a newbie DM, and I've been wanting to run a campaign for evil player characters.
Ooh.
My only problem is that I can't find many higher-level monsters that are good-ish. I assume for the evil folks to slay. And so this writer would like to know if we have any advice.
So it depends on the tone of your campaign, because you can always have evil guys fight other evil guys. I mean, that's always a good fallback option. One other option you can look at.
And by the way, I should note that the letter writer states that their inspiration is the Paths of Darkness books by R.A. Salvatore.
Oh, okay. So maybe the characters will drown.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, an easy thing you can do would be to take some what look like evil guys and do some flavor changes to them. So if you're going to be fighting elves, you could take, say, the higher level Eladrin, a hag. I'd avoid drow just because I think that would just be too... I mean, their flavor is very strong the way it is. But recast those as elves. Maybe add elven accuracy. Maybe change some of the flavor. Maybe import some powers from other, like, more elvish fey monsters and use those. But honestly, yeah, you're going to have to do a little work on your end because we don't support the evil campaign out of the box.
The thing is, though, 4th edition is so full of unaligned monsters that... You know, those monsters that don't care who they're fighting, who have no moral disposition, particularly, you know, oozes, various beasts, or, you know, like the Tarrasque does not care if you're good or evil.
Yeah,
it just wants to eat you.
Yeah.
And so the game just has a lot of monsters that whether the player characters are good or evil, those monsters are going to be a threat and are worthy opponents.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are also... You know, metallic dragons that if the evil guys specifically want to go against things that are sort of classically good, even though in 4th not all metallic dragons are good, they could have a campaign where those are the dragons they face more often than the chromatic dragons.
Yeah, and I think the context is really important. Like, if they're fighting against the minions of a gold dragon, those mm-hmm. minions are going to be good. It's going to feel, the flavor is going to be correct. You know, I think that's really the important thing. So in the campaigns I've played with evil characters, we actually didn't really, like, seek out and fight, like, good creatures. We were more, like, criminals who may be backstabbing other criminal gangs, things like that, like plotting to take over the town, so to assassinate the mayor or to seize power through a revolution or whatever. So I think there's a lot of ways. I mean, if you think about it in general, classically evil D&D characters, in my experience, are more just they're power hungry and they're willing to do whatever it takes to get that power.
Right.
So it doesn't necessarily mean you have to cast them as fighting specifically good creatures. They could just be fighting whoever's in their way. You know, they could be fighting, if let's say, for example, you have an evil cleric in the party, a cleric of, Hextor or someone like that. He may decide, you know what, I need to bump off the priest who's above me in the hierarchy. That's my enemy, because I want to become the high priest of Hextor in this area.
And that's
my enemy.
And it's a classic theme for evil to turn on evil.
Yeah, exactly.
And you bring up a great point about the evil character often being focused on power rather than just wreaking havoc.
Yeah, exactly.
And so their main allies might actually be good beings, you know, other humanoid races or good monsters, because it might be in that character's interest to help that noble knighthood, because that noble knighthood then might prop up that character's duchy or barony that
yeah.
they're trying to take over.
Yeah, you think of almost like Raistlin from the Dragonlance saga and the role he played. where he eventually turned to the Black Robes. But he helped the Companions because he wasn't necessarily interested in having the Dragon High Lords conquer Ancelon, because then he would not be able to seize power.
Well, and part of what makes him such a fascinating character still is he turned to darkness in the end, yet he had the most pivotal role in basically helping to contain the goddess of evil.
Yeah. Now, you don't have to go all that out in your evil campaign and have, you know, but it still just gives you some ideas of where, how you can twist things, and it doesn't necessarily have to be the characters are hunting down Quaddles and fighting traditionally good aligned monsters, quote-unquote monsters in D&D.
Well, that's it for this podcast mailbag. So please keep sending in your questions, whether they're about rules or your campaigns or your snacks.
Or about characters like Ragnar Thunderwacker.
Yes.
And yeah. It should be pointed to in this email, for the sake of Mr. Thunderwacker's character development, let it be possible. It is possible. Well, that's it for this installment of the D&D podcast. Thanks for tuning in. And as usual, thank you to Bart Carroll, our dauntless producer. And thank you to my co-host, not sidekick, not henchman, not minion, but co-host, Jeremy Crawford.
Also known as Power Behind the Throne.
Power Behind the Throne. Oh, if only I had a throne. Once again, thanks a lot for listening. And if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, drop a line to dndinsider@wizards.com. And also as a reminder, Jeremy and I will both be at PAX Labor Day weekend in Seattle. There's going to be a big D&D bus on site where we're going to be doing some previews of the Red Box and just a general celebration of D&D. So stop on by and say hi. And until next episode, take it easy and keep gaming.